call the Special Committee on Oil and Gas, the Senate Special Committee on Oil and Gas to order. Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Dyson, Senator Steadman, Senator Wilken, Senator Elton, Senator Bundy, Senator Wagner, myself, Senator Seekins. It's now the second day of June. It's 6 minutes after the hour of 11 a.m. Senator Wagner and Senator Green is also with us. Senator Wagner yesterday asked that we have someone from our legislative legal office be available, and if we could get him to come on up. And you could just introduce yourself for the record and to the members.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dennis Bailey, and I'm from the Ledge Legal, and I'm here to address questions from the committee and go from there.
Senator Wagner.
My request primarily was I wanted somebody from our side, Ledge Legal, to come in front of us and more or less review the bill and some of the parts of the bill with us as to what authority, if any, the legislature might be giving up if this these amendments to the Stranded Gas Act were to be passed.
This is on Senate Bill 2004, by the way.
Yes. So if you could just give us a short report on that.
I can address that question for you. I think that there's essentially two areas in the bill that might be considered compromising or eroding the legislature. The first one I don't think is any secret to anyone, and that's the provisions related to taxation. On page 3 of the bill, beginning on line 3, there's a section that allows the commissioner to negotiate terms related to modification of taxes, which would be a change in taxes by contract. And there's also a provision in that same section, or paragraph 1, related to negotiating credits. I think that would be one area that question of negotiating taxes within the contract. We can go into that in more depth, but it's one of the areas I think the members are familiar with, and it's one of the areas in this bill that erode the power of the legislature. I'd be happy to get into that in more detail if you'd want, but I think the issue is pretty well known. The second area that the bill addresses that is potentially an erosion of legislative authority is the section that relates to waiver of sovereign immunity. And this is also on page 3 near the bottom of the page. Essentially what it discusses is waiver of, as I understand it, is waiver of the protection that the state enjoys under the U.S. Constitution, the 11th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which prohibits a state from being sued in federal court. And as I understand it, the provision, and it's essentially on lines 29, 30, and 31, discusses waiver of sovereign immunity for entrance and enforcement of an arbitration award. Statute has provisions that allow, already has provisions that allow waiver of immunity by the Attorney General for wetlands issues. And that's a specific grant of legislative immunity. This one is a little bit broader, but essentially this is a similar grant of a power with the concurrence of the Attorney General to waive sovereign immunity, which would allow an arbitration award to be entered in federal court. That's my understanding of the provision. So to the extent that it doesn't specify specifically a specific area, it may be somewhat of an erosion of legislative power.
The first recognized Senate
Senator Ben Stevens is here, and also welcome and recognize Senator Gary Stevens is also here in attendance with us today, and I don't see any other members at this time. Thank you. Go ahead.
Other than that, those are the two main areas that might be considered erosion of legislative power. Without being too general or generalized, I think that the bill essentially grants power to the commissioner to negotiate terms and, you know, being able to understand what those terms are and how they work really isn't a question of eroding legislative power.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. And knowing that some of these questions are constitutional and there are people who specialize in constitutional law, would you generally say that these two erosions that you mentioned, are they policy calls that are allowable, or do they bring into question constitutionality?
Well, clearly the power to taxation is a constitutional issue. Whether the state can contractually agree, let me put that a little bit differently, whether the administration could negotiate a change in taxes essentially outside of the legislative process. I think that's a question that will be answered, and it's a constitutional magnitude. The question on sovereign immunity is, I guess the magnitude of the question isn't as grand, and clearly the state has the power to grant the authority to waive sovereign immunity. They've done it in the general waiver of sovereign immunity statute for contracts and torts. They've done it in this particular statute that relates to federal wetland questions, and it's not really the constitutional issue as much as a legislative issue.
Thank you.
Dennis, if we have a general waiver for contracts and torts, would that apply to this particular contract, even without it being specifically mentioned in this contract, or is it necessary because it relates to an arbitration award?
The latter. As I understand it, and understand this is the administration's bill, I believe that the purpose of the bill is to waive the sovereign immunity for purposes of entering an arbitration award as a judgment for enforcement purposes in federal court. And that's the waiver that I believe is attempted to be written into the bill.
It looks to me.
Go ahead. The second portion of that section that does this says that you have to try and enter the award in state court first.
Right.
And if that presumably is not successful or doesn't work, then the ability to enter the award in federal court is granted by the waiver of the sovereign immunity.
In that regard, when I take a look at lines 30 and 31 on line 3, on page 3, it says, consent to entrance and enforcement of an arbitration award in any state court in the United States that has jurisdiction over the state. What courts in the United States, state courts in the United States, have jurisdiction over the state?
I think you've identified a language problem in the bill. I don't think there is one.
I've been told that this is the, I forget, the Special Committee on Natural Gas Development. Oh, they've been corrected so that I call the right committee to order.
if I can address that question for
yep.
you. It's a linguistic technicality, if you want to call it that. If you phrase the sentence to read consent to entrance and enforcement of an arbitration award in any state court, and then the waiver applies in the United States that has jurisdiction over the state it's a phrasing issue that really should be clarified.
Would that read better, any state of Alaska court?
Would be reluctant to suggest a modification that without being really clear on what the intent of the bill is.
Right. Maybe I should ask the administration that question as well. So Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I also thought there was a problem with this. And I wondered if the word state in line 31 really meant a state in which there was activity related to this project. As in, if the pipeline, after it gets across Canada, is in the Great Lakes area, so a state court where there was activity going on, that's what it was talking about. And we really do need to figure out who was talking about what here.
Jim, do you have an answer for us on that as well? Maybe if you could come up and take the other seat next to Dennis there.
Yes, my name, for the record, is Jim Baldwin. I'm a counsel to the Attorney General's office. Our reading of this and the purpose of this is to allow there to be enforcement of arbitration awards outside of the state of Alaska if they are unsuccessful in obtaining enforcement within the state of Alaska, to allow them additional remedies beyond the borders of the state of Alaska. And what this is intended to do is to obtain the proper authority from the legislature for the administration to do that, because under the 11th Amendment of the Constitution or under other common law theories relating to sovereign immunity, the state is immune from suit outside of its borders unless by law authority is granted to accept suit outside of our borders. So what we're doing here is asking for a proper authority to agree to a term of that nature in the contract. I have been in cases where the state has been involved in other state courts. They only have jurisdiction if the state consents to the jurisdiction or participates in a way that it is perceived to be consenting to that jurisdiction. Now, as to Senator Dyson's question, I believe that the purpose here is that if there is the ability or an asset of the state located in another jurisdiction, that the enforcement would be sought in that jurisdiction in which they could obtain some relief on their judgment. So it not only involves activity, pipeline activity, it really involves assets of the state and whether they can obtain a satisfaction of their against their award.
It appears to me, Senator Dyson, go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking of the averse of that if we were involved in a dispute with a company who headquartered in another state and we were trying to enforce the terms of the arbitration in that state, that we might be wanting to go into that state's court to force compliance there. Wouldn't we also want to be able to do that?
It's possible, yes.
So I think, Mr. Chairman, you're on the right track here, that we probably do need to get this clarified. It sounds like there's at least three different ways that we might be wanting to seek a remedy in another state's court.
That's kind of where I'm looking at. And now also, as I understand this, gentlemen, while the terms of that contract may allow it, it would have to allow it to be done with the concurrence of the Attorney General. So it's not on a blanket approval basis. Am I correct there? Would he have to concur each time, or would it be a blanket concurrence that the Attorney General provided?
It it's the intent that when the Attorney General signs the contract after there's been an authorization to sign the contract from the legislature, that would be the consent to the suit.
So will the Attorney General sign the contract, or will the governor sign it, or will the commissioner sign it?
Well, it will be the contract, as I understand it, as contemplated by the parties. There will be a special jurat on the contract for the Attorney General in which he will express his consent.
Okay. So it would be a blanket consent to waive sovereign immunity or other immunity. What other immunity is there other than the sovereign immunity or lawsuit?
If there could be some form of policy-making immunity. I'm not sure what's contemplated there. I mean, I think it's meant to be cover some potential for an immunity that would bar the particular type of enforcement action. If there is some sort of immunity the state could bring, the idea is that the parties are on equal footing here and that there shouldn't be any defenses based on immunity that would prevent a party from enforcing its rights under the contract, or its properly established through the dispute resolution process rights under the contract. So whatever, it's really removing that kind of a defense, whatever it may be. We're being careful here those rights would be fully enforceable.
Okay. Chair would like to recognize and welcome Senator French to the committee. Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I mean, it would be helpful to me, and I don't know that it's fair to ask either our counsel or the governor's counsel or the attorney general's counsel, because it seems to be more of a policy question. But if it is a blanket exception that is granted at the time the contract is signed, I think we need to have a discussion at some point with policymakers to determine why we would want to do it that way rather than have give the authority to the Attorney General to make a decision on as instances may arise in the future. I guess I'm a little bit uncomfortable with just the blanket notion. And I think it probably deserves a policy discussion with somebody other than counsel.
Okay. Other questions at this point? Let me go back to the other question that Dennis, Ms. Bailey brought up in on section 200, section 3 of the bill. It starts at the bottom of page 2. If the commissioner approves an application and proposed project plan, the commissioner may develop a contract that may include terms concerning modifications of taxes on oil and gas, including terms provided for periodic payment in lieu of, and terms related to credits for investment. These terms are still subject to legislative approval prior to the execution of the contract. With that in mind, Dennis, does this encroach on legislative authority as to powers of taxation to the high degree that it would be if we gave them the ability to just negotiate it without legislative approval?
I think that the question is whether the legislature is giving up its taxing authority, its constitutional taxing authority, by permitting the commissioner to negotiate tax terms, modification of taxes under this bill. It's an issue that's unresolved, I believe, but I think it appears that a contractual modification of the tax of the state's taxing system would be contrary to the Constitution.
Okay. Would Would that, in effect, be because the question has come up as to if the taxes are included in a contract, that could preclude future legislatures from modifying those taxes through the duration of the contract. Is that also part of that intrusion into that legislative power taxation?
I think you're getting a little bit outside of my area discussing the stranded gas tax,
right,
but I'll try to address the question, at least in general terms. If it is permitted under the Constitution to include tax modifications within the contract, and those modifications exist, then a subsequent legislature would have difficulty changing the tax structure that's incorporated in the contract by a subsequent litigation because it would interfere with an existing contract. But that's a big if. And the big if is whether it's permissible to include that in the contract in the first place.
Okay. The chair would like to recognize and welcome Senator Huggins to the committee. Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I see a couple of levels of the application here, and please help me if I'm incorrect here. One question and one level of the application would be the commissioner negotiates the contract and then the legislature approves or disapproves, so they basically are voting on that taxation.
Correct.
So that we're still in the loop there. That issue, of course, and in the related notion of whether we can put something firm into the contract for 20, 30 years will be decided by the Supreme Court. But as I read this, I'm wondering if there isn't, a broader implication here where we've approved this contract that says the commissioner can modify taxes, and so sometime in the future, the commissioner could modify taxes. I mean, it'd have to be basically reopening the contract and with all participants of the contract approval, but that the commissioner could renegotiate taxes, and then there is no proviso for them to come back and have that renegotiated contract approved by the legislature. So, I mean, am I drifting too far afield here?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I think that you're correct. I don't know that I have an answer for you.
And Mr. Chairman, just if I can clarify for myself, there's two applications of Section 3 then. One, before the legislature approves or disapproves of the contract, and another after the legislature approves or disapproves, and the legislature would not get a bite at the apple on the latter one. Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my interpretation of the Stranded Gas Act that the legislature gave the commissioner the authority to negotiate the terms of the taxes for payment in lieu of taxes. Not to modify the taxes, but to create a payment structure in lieu of taxes. And then that's what the contract does. And that was allowed if the payment in terms of the negotiated payment in lieu of taxes achieved the objective of the Stranded Gas Act, which was to bring the resource to market and to encourage the development of the North Slope resources. So the concept of giving the authority to the commissioner to negotiate taxes, I don't agree with, and I don't think that's what we've done. What we've done is we've allowed the commissioner to negotiate a payment in lieu of the tax structure for a periodic period of time that creates a project to bring the resources to market. It's obvious from the deliberations we heard down at Centennial Hall in terms of Article 9, Sections 1 and Article 9, Section 4, and also the contractual clause of the U.S. Constitution, that the question of whether the legislature can take that, give the authority to the administration to take that power of payment in lieu of taxes and to carry it forward is going to be a question that's going to be resolved in the courts. There's no question about that. We all know that that is the piece that's going to go to be challenged in the Supreme Court. The question we have is whether we're going to make a decision on whether to move a project forward or not. We're not going to solve the question of whether this legislature has the ability to grant a payment in lieu of taxes for a period of time in the future. We're going to have a question of whether we want to make the commitment to get that question to the Supreme Court.
Okay, Senator Hoffman, then Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would agree with Senator Stevens that that was the case for payment in lieu of taxes, but it seems to me that when you're looking at on page 3, lines 3 and 4, item 1, the second part of the sentence says including terms provided for a periodic payment in lieu of one or more taxes. But before that, it says that the commissioner may contract modifications of taxes on oil. So that is the question of why are we expanding it then to include modifications on taxing on oil, but it also includes the terms for the payment of lieu and taxes that you mentioned. If that's what we're trying to get at, then maybe the first part of that sentence should not be included.
Senator Dyson, then Senator Stedman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hoffman actually said exactly about what I was going to. Seems to me that the original or the existing Stranded Gas Act language allows for, probably appropriately, the commissioner to make arrangements for payments in lieu of taxes, and it is indeed the new language that we are amending in here that raises concerns for me. And that's why I asked the question yesterday, when did this new language show up, you know, in the administration's consideration? And I understood 4 or 6 weeks ago or so that they started working on this piece, which is also a concern.
Mr. Baldwin, any comment?
Well, the intent here is to make it clear that the contract can provide for payments in lieu of oil and gas taxes, particularly oil taxes. The legislative history that was created in 1998 was that the payment in lieu authority only applied to taxes on gas, even though the wording that you see, I think it is in section 210, describes, and that's the existing language appears on page 4, describes the types of taxes as being oil and gas, exploration, production, and that sort of thing. But the legislative history was very strong that the legislature's grant of power only applied to agreeing to payments in lieu of taxes on gas. So our purpose here is not really to give carte blanche power to the administration to change tax laws, but to agree to more or less what Senator Stevens is saying, the ability to agree to payments in lieu that apply to oil. That's what we're trying to do, and I'll take responsibility for the inartful use of the word phrase modification of taxes, because that's certainly not our intent here. Our intent is to authorize the provisions in the contract which provide for payments in lieu, which are equivalent to oil, taxes on oil.
Stevens, Bundy, I mean, Stedman, Stevens, Bundy. I see.
Mr. Chairman, I don't see the link that referenced earlier. Once we move beyond the application accepted by the commissioner on line one, page three, of a proposed project, and then you fall into the language as far as modifying taxes on oil and gas, dealing with the proposed application and project. I don't see the link in there after that to go back in and change by the commissioner the tax structure that was referenced earlier. I don't see how that is linked in this bill.
I don't see it linked in the bill either. I don't know if any terms are included in the contract that would allow any kind of a renegotiation at any time forward, but I didn't see anything in it when I read through it either. Mr. Donald Baldwin, what did you
A renegotiation of the payments in lieu?
Right, or of modification of taxes on oil in the future, other than what would be included in the contract when it was first executed.
I'm not aware of any provision to that effect.
Senator Bundy, then Stevens, Dyson.
Thank you.
Like a law firm.
And I think I did hear legal say, however, that that could be conceived as something that would occur after. And so I have a question for Mr. Baldwin. Is it the administration's intent that the commissioner be able to renegotiate after the contract payment in lieu of taxes?
After the contract has been authorized by the legislature.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of such an intent.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
I don't mean to sound too tentative here, but I'm not quite. Yeah.
Well, and I'm not put off by a lack of certainty, because there seems to be one certain thing about this project is a lack of certainty. Mr. Chairman, I do share some concern about that has been expressed by others about the notification, idea that modification of taxes before the comma there. I understand Senator Stevens' point, and I agree that it was aimed at payment in lieu of taxes, that phrasing about modification may cause a broader interpretation that I'd be interested in supporting. And I'm glad to hear the administration even tentatively saying that they do not view this power by the commissioner to extend beyond the ratification of the contract and to continue into the future. I don't know if it's necessary that this be rephrased to indicate that this power that we're granting the commissioner applies only to activities before the ratification of the contract by the legislature.
For the record, Senator Kukish has joined us. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, a couple of comments. The first comment is that in the Stranded Gas Act, that's one of the unfortunate things about when we talk about amendments, if we talk about bills, we don't have the entire act in front of us. But if on page two, hold on a second. Yeah, I don't even think it is there.
We did provide everybody with a copy of the Stranded Gas Act yesterday.
Yeah, okay, well, let's just look at that. If you look at 010, the purpose of paragraph 2 is to allow the fiscal terms applicable to a qualified sponsor or members of a sponsor group with respect to a project to be tailored to a particular economic condition project and to establish those fiscal terms in advance with as much certainty as the Constitution allows.
Correct.
So then you go to, I go, Mr. Chairman, to what I consider one of the important parts of the bill, the 4382-200, contract development, which is on page 5 of that first handout. And if you go down, Mr. Chair, 4382-210, contract terms relating to payment in lieu of one or more taxes.
That's 210, correct?
210. Right. I don't want to read the paragraph, but I think that paragraph's important. The periodic payment in lieu of one or more taxes that otherwise would be imposed by the state or municipality on a qualified sponsor as a consequence of participating in the project. The number one item, Mr. Chairman, oil and gas production taxes or surcharges under 4355. I mean, we all remember what SB 305, what that chapter dealt with. Now, there's been some disagreement on whether the fact that the Stranded Gas Act did have to do with oil, but for those of us that take a strict literal reading of the law, to me, that says oil and gas production taxes under 4355. And so...
Well, we got a typo. You found a typo there. No? No, it's there. There it is.
The next one, Mr. Chairman, oil and gas exploration, production, and pipeline transportation is under 4356.
Yep.
Which is the transportation and tariff charges. So... I mean, the comment that comes from some of the legal minds that have been studying this, I'm not a legal mind, but I can read law, and I interpret the law the way I interpret it. And in a strict reading of the law, that's a strict reading of the law, that those taxes under 4355 are subject to negotiation of a PILT. And so when we look at the terms in back again on page 3 of the 2004 bill, it says terms concerning modifications of taxes on oil and gas, which provided for terms of the PILT. I mean, to me, it's just restating what we're doing in 4382-210A.
I'm curious to that effect, and next will be Senator Dyson and then Senator Elton. But on that effect, Jim, on that topic, it appears to me also that 210 is a restatement of that section of 200. Am I correct?
Well, there is a little bit of restating going on between the various sections. That's true. What the problem that is caused for the lawyers who read this is in section 210, and it appears on page 4 of the bill in front of you, the language that we're taking out there on lines 8, 9, and 10, which says as a consequence of participating in an approved qualified project, we're talking about a gas project there. So you're talking about payment of one or more taxes that would be imposed as a consequence of a gas project. And then you got the string there of taxes that are listed as oil and gas, and then there was quite a colloquy in the House Special Committee on Oil and Gas in 1998 about this. And so it's based on that history and that concern that we've asked to make the amendments in 200 and 210 that are before you.
Chairman,
on that point, Senator Stevens?
On that point.
Go ahead.
On that point, and I don't disagree with your statement, Mr. Baldwin, but any of the adjustments in the oil tax under 4355 that are applied to the PILT only apply to the qualified sponsor group, not the entire a class that are subject to 4355. So I take the interpretation that it is tied to the gas project, because only those that sign the sponsor agreement are subject to the bill. 4355 applies to all other entities subject to those taxes across the state.
Well, I think you're making very good legislative history for us here, but what we would like to do is to counter the legislative history that was created in 1998, and we think these amendments would give us that comfort. That's why they were presented. Beyond that, it's a policy call from the legislature what you want to do on it, but that's our thinking on it.
Okay, Senator Dyson, then Senator Elton, then Senator Hoffman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I'm following the gist of this conversation, the modifications we're making here in Section 3 are only to give the commissioner the authority to develop a contract that will, in essence, substitute PILT payments for oil tax payments. And if that's true, I think we lose nothing and gain a bit if we clarify this language here in line 3 and 4 and perhaps line 5 to make sure that it's only given the commissioner the authority to offer a contract with PILTs, as opposed to one reading of it in isolation would be that he could change the terms of the tax structure that underlies what might be substituted in a PILT thing. So I've drafted a little language here, but I suspect the two gentlemen at the end of the table could do a far better job of just making sure it's clear that in this particular section is consistent with what I understand the argument at the table here today, that we're only talking about substituting of PILTs for taxes.
Okay. Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr.
Chair.
You
could provide that, your rough draft to the...
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I mean, I would just suggest, I share the same concerns that the previous speaker made. I would just suggest that the original language on lines 3 and 4 does exactly what he is suggesting, and that the new language that's inserted is not needed. And I'd specifically note that that the original language references 4382.210, and then if you go to that, which is on page 4, you see that they are striking the language that could create some confusion on whether or not the provisions of this are intended just for gas. And then, as Senator Stevens has already pointed out, on line 11 on page 4, it specifically references oil and gas production taxes. So under the payment in lieu of tax section 210. So, I mean, I just think that the original language takes care of the concerns that we've heard expressed around the table, because we're clarifying oil and gas in the amendment in section 5.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the Stranded Gas Act, the contract development section, at the top of the page 5, that's the language that we're amending. And I guess if, in fact, the language under 210 does state, as Senator Stevens has said, that it already includes provisions, and these are contract terms, and the other one at the top of the page are contract development, has the inclusion of the of oil and gas production taxes and surcharges, then why are we looking at the changing the language under 200 for contract development to include the modification, or is this the just clarification language as you see it, but it also goes on and includes the negotiation of the credits, which hasn't even been discussed yet. So I'm wondering if the Stranded Gas Act says what Senator Stevens says it does, why are we tinkering with the language under contract development at this point?
Mr. Chairman, our purpose was to have the provisions be parallel to the extent we can.
The way I read it, maybe I'm in wrong, but the way I read it, Section 200 says contract development. You can develop a contract along this line. Then it says here are the contract terms that you can include in that contract development, these terms related to these issues. It kind of says, in one hand, maybe I'm reading it wrong, you can develop a contract, and that contract can may include these kinds of terms, and further down, in terms of the contract terms related to payment in lieu of one or more taxes, 210 basically now would be relating itself back to 200 paragraph 1. It says 200 paragraph 1, when you're developing this contract regarding terms concerning periodic payment in lieu of one or more taxes, you can do it. These are the contract terms that you can include in that section of the contract you're developing. That's kind of how I read it. Am I off base there?
No, I think that's a very good explanation of it. One sort of sets the table from a little bit higher elevation, then the next section goes into the details of it.
And so in that regard, if we say that we're allowing modification of taxes on oil and gas, including terms provided for periodic payment, one or more taxes provided in 210, and as provided in 210, it's basically referring down to 210. So we're just saying that we're allowing you to modify it according to the terms contained in 210 and terms related to credits for investment that is the subject of a contract developed under this chapter, which doesn't have a statutory reference under the Stranded Gas Act at this time. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So it's just basically saying now we're going to let you work on this subject, and here's how. Go skip to 210. Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as kind of a follow-up to your discussion, I guess it would be interesting to hear from Legislative Council if on page 3, we don't insert the new language on 3 and 4 and revert to the original language, terms concerning periodic payment in lieu of taxes. And then we make the change by deleting the language on page 4, lines 8 through 10, so that there is no question that we're talking only about gas. Whether or not we still have the constitutional issue that you raised in your earlier testimony.
Could you clarify for me what you were suggesting on page 4 for lines 4 through 10?
Well, I'm not suggesting anything there, but according to the counsel for the Attorney General's office said that that language was being stricken, and I hope I'm paraphrasing correctly. That language was being stricken because they didn't want there to be, because of previous discussion, they didn't want there to be any question that we were talking only about gas, but we were talking about oil and gas. And I think that's why he noted that they were striking that language in the bill.
I think that language leads to the interpretation you're only talking about gas.
Right. So given that if we revert to the original language in the bill on page 3, lines 3 and 4, and if you strike the additional language of modification of taxes on oil and gas, including terms providing for, whether or not if we strike that language, are we eliminating the constitutional question that you testified to earlier?
Go ahead.
If you're addressing that question to me, through the chair.
You don't have to answer through the chair. Relax.
I think the answer is yes. I mean, the concern in this draft of this bill is that you're proposing to modify taxes by way of a contract.
Right.
And it's been suggested in the discussion here that that's not the intent of the administration. if you remove that language and have being able to negotiate payments in lieu of taxes is quite different than negotiating the tax itself in a contract.
But just as a follow-up, Mr. Chair, I think the original language accomplishes what the administration is trying to do when it comes to payment in lieu of taxes, and I think we've eliminated the issue of whether we're speaking only of gas, or the question about whether we could be only speaking about gas, by the changes on page 5, lines 8 through 11. So my recommendation is we just keep the original language.
Okay. Are we done discussing that? We'll bring, as I said earlier, we're going to bring amendments, and we're going to do that on Sunday afternoon, by the way. We'll start at 2 o'clock Sunday on amendments. Other questions for the gentleman, for Dennis? Mr. Bailey, as long as we have legislative legal here, any other questions that we need to address to legislative legal? Okay, and perhaps just for the benefit of the legislators, Dennis, if I could ask you to put together just a little written summary of the sovereign immunity question. We're questioned with this all the time, and if we could just have a brief of what sovereign immunity is, where we've waived it in the past, and what the effect of waiving sovereign immunity here on this bill would be.
I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for Dennis? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe this is not a fair question to you, but are you as confident of the Supreme Court's ruling when this gets there as the administrative council has been? And you can choose not to answer the question.
I would hate to speculate. I mean, I don't know the answer to the question. It could go.
I'm not asking for the question. I'm just asking for what your thinking is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Senator Olson. Other questions for Mr. Bailey, Senator Stevens, and Senator Dyson?
Might just comment, but I think maybe we ought to give the Supreme Court the opportunity to make that decision.
I'm sure, as you pointed out, Senator Stevens, that the Supreme Court is going to indeed make the decision. I just wanted to know what, as compared to the administrative staff council, legislative council, and see if there was, you know, a real disparity between the two opinions, or whether they were right in collusion with each other, and we'd just go straight there.
Let me take a brief, and then I'm going to ask Senator Dyson. Steve Thompson, are you still online with us? I got to ask you a question.
Thompson in Fairbanks.
Steve, I'm sure you've been stimulated by our discussion this morning, but we're going to probably get to you after lunch, and if you could we can get through to you on another line or call your office back. We can get a number where we can call you and give you 15 minutes notice where we start talking about the economic and effects of a pipeline and the revenue effects of a pipeline. Maybe we can let you go to lunch here.
Okay. Do you have any idea about what time you're going to be calling back?
It'll be after, probably around 2 o'clock, Steve.
I can make sure that I'm here and available. Do you want my number now, or do you want me to give it to somebody else? Or?
Well, if you give your number now, the whole state will have it. So if it's just your office number, we know what it is. And
yes, my office number would be fine, 459-6793. That's the office number.
So. All right. Thank you.
All right.
Hey, Steve, this is Senator Wagner. Just make sure that hadn't got a 760 prefix on it, okay?
Hey, I was down there 2 weeks ago. It's too hot down there.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor. Let's Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I perhaps wasn't listening as attentively as I should have when you were asking for some more comments on the sovereignty explanation, but we sure need that to be clarified, what it means about in other states, and under what circumstances we want to use other states' courts to enforce our arbitration. Okay. And I think we at least had three different possibilities there, and I think we need to know what the administration intended, and if there, and make that very clear, and if there's anything else, any other circumstances that have come to light that we might want to use other courts, other states' courts, to enforce arbitration decision related to our project.
Mr. Baldwin, could we ask you to maybe help us with that later this afternoon?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we'll get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
On that point, Mr. Chairman.
On that point, Senator Hoffman.
I wonder if there's has been any instance that the state has given up its sovereign rights in the past.
Okay, thank you. Senator Stevens.
On a different subject.
Different subject.
Actually, back to the discussion, Mr. Chairman, on page 3 and the language that was inserted on lines 3 through 5.
Okay.
And I'm sorry I didn't have the information when we were discussing that, but I have the information now. And if you, it's my interpretation, Mr. Chairman, that lines 3 through 5 relate to Article Exhibit P of the contract. And Exhibit P of the contract is the method to determine the PPT PILT payment. And if you've had the opportunity to read Article P on page 360 of the contract, it says net production value of the PPT on oil and PPT for gas. That's Article P3, and it says replaces Alaska Statute 4355-160. And as we call ourselves around here now code heads, if you know what that code is, 160 is the determination of value for the production tax. And so the way I interpret the necessity of having a modification of taxes on oil and gas, including the terms provided for periodic payments, is that this section,
okay,
Article P, because this lays out portions of the 160 that apply to the North Slope and don't apply to other areas. And so there is a modification in the tax code that's incorporated into Article P. And so that's why I interpret the necessity for that statement, right? I just wanted to clarify that. As I said, if members look at Exhibit P and Exhibit R, Exhibit R, which is the determination of method to determine petroleum production tax lease expenditures. And if we recall what lease expenditures are, they're deductible from the tax value. And so, and the reason, and the modification has taken place in terms of the fact that not all of the provisions in 4355-160 are incorporated into the PILT, only portions that apply to that production region. I just wanted to put that on the record, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Very good. Other questions? We're going to ask Mr. Bailey, as soon as we can, to work on that issue of sovereign immunity. Are there any other questions for Mr. Bailey before we allow him to leave? Seeing none, we're going to recess this committee until 2 o'clock. Reconvene the Special Committee on Natural Gas Development, and We have, before we left, we were talking about 2000, Senate Bill 2004, so let's continue on with 2004. And we had asked, we'd been talking about the provisions on the, in 2004, dealing with the economically affected and revenue affected municipalities along the route of the line. And we've asked Senator Wilkin, we have Steve Thompson available. Steve, I believe, is the chair of the Municipal Advisory Group. Steve, are you online with us still?
Yes, I am, Senator.
Thank you for being so patient this today, and if you would introduce yourself for the record for the members.
Yes, my name is Steve Thompson. I'm the mayor of the city of Fairbanks, and I'm also the chairman of the Municipal Advisory Group that was appointed when the Stranded Gas Act kicked in with an application. There are a total of about 13 different communities that are represented that could be affected by the construction during construction period and ramp up of the gas line.
We're speaking primarily. Well, Senator Wilkin, maybe I could just ask you to pose some of your questions with Mayor Thompson.
Yes, Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity. The questions arise out of the bottom of page 7 in version A, payments to economically affected municipalities, and then there's also reference to revenue affected municipalities. And, Mayor, I'm not sure where the Municipal Advisory Group is in this. But it raised some concerns to me as the differences in the definitions, and as we've gotten into it, it raised some additional questions as to what the two definitions mean, and then how the communities or the municipalities are treated differently. Have you had discussions with the Municipal Advisory Group in regard to the differences in treatment and definition with economically affected and revenue-affected municipalities?
Yes, Senator Wilkin. Economic impacts are the ramp-up time and during the construction of the line itself. And those are the dollars that are going to be set aside for impact dollars during construction. The revenue side of it is after station and gas is flowing, how that the revenue would be handled in place of tax, the PILT would be in place then to take place of property tax. And our main concern had been with the economic impact during construction, and the contract has $125 million in there, which is what we asked to have put into that. And then we had a resolution that has been included in what you're addressing starting Wednesday. Last Friday we passed Municipal Advisory Group Resolution 2006-01 to change our term and have us continue on until the impact dollars are completely distributed or until construction is completed and gas is flowing. And then also, there was no formulas or how the money would be distributed, and the Commissioner of Commerce, Community and Economic Development is where that the money looks like with this will end up. We would like to be at least an advisory group to them so that we can have a little bit of input to make sure that these monies are distributed to the places that it's needed.
Mayor, I guess my concern, of course, is the construction period, which is the economically impacted. And I understand now, I think I understand that the $125 million only has to do with the economically impacted communities. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that is correct. And until that there is a contract and we see where that will be, it could have quite a diverse amount of communities and involved all the way from Haines and Skagway to Kenai, Seward, Kenai Borough, Anchorage, and then all of the locations in between, including Valdez. All of these people are on there, the North Slope Borough, City of Delta, all the way through. There's quite a bunch of us. We've been meeting for over 2 years. We sent you last year 8 different resolutions that we had put together that we would like to have seen in a contract to build a line, and now we're back with resolutions to make sure that some things are looked at in depth.
Okay, are you aware, Mayor, that under principle number 1 in the Stranded Gas Amendment, section 4382.510, that the revenue-effective municipalities are given a priority over economically affected municipalities? And did you have a discussion about that and some acknowledgement or approval of that?
Our complete understanding was that the impact funds were for construction period and ramp up to construction only, and that was the $125 million.
Okay, I'll chase that a little bit more. My concern is that, notwithstanding the economic part of it, and it's my understanding, just having seen this yesterday, that the economically affected municipalities essentially, in simple terms, fall away after first gas.
That is correct.
And so then we turn to the revenue affected municipalities, and I'm going to ask someone here in the government to work backwards and take those municipalities that are affected, either revenue or economic, and give us the pro formas that they have worked on in order to show, let us say, first gas impact, and let's say 10 years after, so we can see what that means. I'm concerned that we're going to set up an imbalance on the North Slope with realizing the benefit of those assets, as we have in the past under the 4356 legislation that has concentrated a great deal of asset wealth in one area of the state to the detriment of the rest of the state. So I want to make sure we don't do that again as we walk through this gas line issue. But I wanted to just explore your thoughts and the municipal advisory group's thoughts as to how far in depth you had gotten with this particular issue and how far down the road you looked.
Last Friday passed our resolution 2006-01 asking the extension of time that the municipal advisory group would be in existence, and also then to be an advisory group to the Commissioner of Commerce when it comes time to looking at grants to communities that are affected by construction. And then yesterday we asked 4 more resolutions that were emailed to all of the legislators that expressed some other concerns we had, including education funding that would be greatly impacted by property value excluded or not excluded in the annual full and true value determination for local education funding. Those are something that just popped out at us, and we had the state assessor here, and he went back and dug into it and gave us figures that showed that there would be a possible negative impact if property values were not excluded from the annual full and true value determination of the local education funding. So that is our resolution 03. We had several others that were emailed down to all legislators, and they do have some very important parts that we think will affect the communities in the future.
And Mayor, I appreciate your thoughts. I just wanted to see how far you had worked on the economic and the revenue impacted communities. And in regard to the education issue, we received that, we looked at it, and that's something that my office will work on in regard to the contract itself. The communities, Valdez and North Slope Borough, those that benefit by the 45% rule, of course, are the ones that are impacted the most by the throughput calculation rather than a full and true value. So we're going to work on that from our end because that's something that's going to have to be fixed in the contract. And, Mr. Chairman, probably not something for today, but something that will certainly surface as we work towards a conclusion of approval of the contract. So, Mayor, thank you for your thoughts on those two issues.
Thank you, and our committee is going to continue to meet, and we hope you take into consideration 2006-01 resolution of the MAG group. It is included in the language before you today.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, this is Senator Seekins. I'd like to, have you got a copy of the bill with you?
I do not have a copy of the bill itself in front of me, no.
Okay. The one section on page 9, subparagraph E, basically reads that the Commissioner of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, in consultation with the relevant municipal advisory group established under 4382-510, shall use money appropriated to the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Construction Impact Fund to make grants to municipalities and to nonprofit organizations serving the unorganized borough. Impacts on transportation, infrastructure, law enforcement, emergency services, health and human services, education, labor force, population, wages, and subsistence, and for socio-cultural impacts brought about by the construction of the gas pipeline.
And that is the exact wording we sent down last Friday and was then included in what's before you, plus lengthening out the time that the municipal advisory group would be in existence,
right,
the way it stands in the original bill. We would just go until you ratify a contract, and then we would be done. We would like to stay in existence to be advisors to the Commissioner of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development until the last PIL payment has been, our impact payment has been distributed, so that we can have at least an advisory voice to for them to consider. And we were very pleased to see that these words were included in there in such an efficient and rapid manner.
And I think the next sentence may address it, but we'll see if we have to do something to continue it. But the next sentence basically says, in determining whether an expenditure or a proposed expenditure by a municipality or nonprofit organization is eligible for a grant under this subsection, and in allocating available money among grant proposals, the commissioner shall consider the recommendations of the relevant municipal advisory group and whether or not the proposed expenditure meets the purposes of the section. Does that give you some comfort in the total picture now?
Yes, yes, it does very much. I think there's some other wording in there that does say that we would be in existence for a longer period of time. And the nonprofit would be the Tanana Chiefs Conference that is representing all of the unincorporated areas from the North Slope clear to the Canadian border.
That was my next question, was put a face on the term nonprofit for me. So you're saying that face would be...
The conference was appointed as the representative for the unincorporated areas for the full length of the line to Canada.
Okay. That answers my question on that. Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Mayor. A follow-up question to the previous question about nonprofits and the definition of nonprofit. I mean, it seems to me the wording is broad enough so that, for example, if the Red Cross provided services in the unorganized borough, they may be eligible to get into that impact fund. Am I reading it too broadly?
Well, you might talk. Steve Porter is the one that would probably be able to maybe put more of a restrictive slant onto that. I'm not sure how that fits with how broadly that is. I know somebody mentioned something about that during one of our meetings, and I don't see where it was really addressed to narrow that down.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
And even there, I have some questions on in that unincorporated borough. When you look at the list of those impacts that are on lines 6 through 8, you look at the list of the impacts which can be ameliorated. I'm not sure what that it's just always going to be Tanana Chiefs that handles, for an example, transportation infrastructure.
Yeah, that's a pretty broad language that is there. That's why we'd like to make sure we stay involved so that we could agree or disagree with the Department of Commerce before they turned it over to you.
Okay. Other questions for the mayor? Any other comments you'd like to make to the committee on this special committee on natural gas development, Mayor, from your meetings on your advisory group committee?
Just that we did send all five of our resolutions down, and then we also sent down all eight of our resolutions that we passed in 2004 that we had asked to be included. If you could make sure that you take a look, because that's 13 different entities that are involved and affected by the construction of the line. We feel very strongly that we had some very good points in there that would have an adverse effect if they aren't at least looked at and considered. And I want to thank the entire committee and the Senate and the House down there both for the extra effort you're putting in to try to protect the communities and the citizens of Alaska. And thank you for all your efforts, all of you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Senator Wilken.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mayor, I'm sorry, one other question I had. Yesterday we talked about the process by which an impact request would be made and considered, certified and awarded. What is your understanding from the Municipal Advisory Group on the steps that would, let's say you had a pipe coating yard in Fairbanks and you had to add a new fire station because of that pipe coating yard. What would be the process that that you understand how you would get the impact money to build that fire station?
As far as I know, there is no process or format set up at the present time for the startup of how to apply. So there isn't any particular form set up that, to my knowledge, so far by the administration or by Department of Revenue yet to apply.
Okay. Okay. That helps. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mayor, if you could tell me that you say the Tanana Chiefs is the designated nonprofit organization that is going to be involved with these impact funds. Does this include the impact to the North Slope Borough communities as well?
No, if the community is in the state of the North Slope Borough, they would be represented by the North Slope Borough. We're talking about areas that are not boroughs. The Tolk area all the way back to Delta, between Fairbanks North Star Borough and the North Slope Borough, those areas through that portion of it, you know, the Stevens Village areas, the Yukon River itself, those areas are the ones that are unincorporated. Tanana Chiefs has been assigned to represent unincorporated areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Elton.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, I'm just assuming that we're talking about Alaska communities. I mean, I can see impacts happening in Whitehorse. Would they be eligible for impact aid?
Absolutely not. Just inside of the state of Alaska to the border.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions for the mayor? Seeing none, thank you for your time and your patience, Mr. Mayor. We appreciate your input today.
Yes, I appreciate it, too. I think one of our resolutions even talks about that there's going to be four outtake parts. The one for Southeastern looks like it's going to come up in Canada, so that was one of our concerns also. So thank you very much. We appreciate what you're doing down there.
Thank you. Let's see, Kevin Ritchie is here from AML. Mr. Ritchie, would you care to testify with us on this?
Chairman, only if you have questions. The mayor did a wonderful job explaining what the MAG's been doing.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Ritchie? Seeing none, we'll move on. Let's see. We have. We asked the administration to provide an expert on this topic for us. We got Jim.
Cut me off.
Oh, we didn't mean to cut you off, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Jim Baldwin, Counsel of the Attorney General's Office.
Go ahead, Mr. Baldwin. Senator Wilken would like to delve into some of his questions on the economically affected and revenue-affected communities, if we could. Senator Wilken?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've just got a punch list of things that I'd like to work on, Jim, and I don't know who to work on with, but let me go down and then you can maybe point me in the right direction.
Yes, sir.
Let's start with page 9, section or paragraph E. This is the section that talks about how you award the grants and they're considered. Part of this could be done in regulation, but I would like to put into law that this be done in public so that there's no question about these decisions being made in the future in a public forum. So that's first request. Second is there a way that we could put in here, without being too detailed, the manner in which and who makes the decisions on whether something is or is not impacted?
As I said, I think in my testimony the other day, that our approach, I think, would be to do this in regulation, understanding sometimes the legislature wants to be more specific than that. We could try to do that in statute. I'm sure it can be done. The question is, you know, it's a matter of time and effort.
Well, maybe we could leave it at that as a concern. Certainly the public process is something I'll do the best I can to make sure it's part of the bill.
But again, Senator, it would be how to determine that whether something is severely impacted.
Yeah, and I'm not sure of the process, but Fairbanks puts in a request for a new fire station. It goes to somebody. Somebody qualifies that. It goes to someone else that certifies it. It goes somewhere else to fund it. All those things have to be done in public. If they're done by the department, fine, but it has to be in a public forum.
So you're talking more in terms of process than it is in sort of defining what an impact is.
And that's my next question. But yes, yeah. I just want to make sure that those things are done in public, however that is defined.
Kind of like that a new swimming pool in Tok would have to fit into the definition of what a real impact was, you know, something along that line.
Yeah. So Jim, if you could help me with that in the next day or so. Secondly, page 8, line 24. We've had considerable discussions about what direct and severe impacts are. I have a definition of impact that's as good as anybody's because it's the only one somebody's offered up. I would like to put that in the bill to give whoever is making these decisions some sort of sideboards on what an impact is. Impacts are subjective, but at the same time, there is the ability to put some sideboards on things that aren't impacted. And so I'm going to, I have that definition, and whomever I'm supposed to work with, I'd be more than happy to roll that into an amendment to give to the chairman. So just tell me who I should work with on that.
You should give it to me, and we'll help you draft it up. Okay.
We'll get that definition. Third, page 7, line 31 through page 9. This is the whole issue about the revenue-impacted communities and the economically-impacted communities. It's my understanding, as I've learned this over the last 24 hours, that the economically-impacted communities deal with $125 million, and as I said earlier, at first gas, that issue just goes away. And so now we're dealing with revenue-impacted communities, and that's a definition by the commissioner. I'm wondering a couple of things. I'm wondering if you take, as the mayor said, there's 11 communities. I don't know how many there are, but there's 11 entities that are going to be affected by those definitions. Has someone run the impact, given the throughputs, which we're now going to base these PILT payments on? It's no longer based on full and true value as we do today. It's based on throughputs. Has somebody run the pro formas for the revenue-affected entities? Best guess, high-low, for that language in this bill?
I'll have to check and get back to you.
Okay. I'd like to see that. And then as a subset of that, I don't know, if anything, whether on 4382510 in the Stranded Gas Amendment, Principle 1, in regard to the revenue effective municipalities trumping the economically affected municipalities. I don't know if that applies today, if that language from 3 or 4 years ago applies to this bill, but if you'd let me know if that's something I should be concerned about.
I'm concerned about the priority. I don't know if you've had a chance to get the memo, but we wrote a memo to you that was just delivered.
Okay.
And we take the position that those criteria that are listed in 020B are, in the first instance, they're directory, not mandatory. I mean, the way they're worded is that you should do this, you should do that. I mean, when the legislature wants us to do something, it's pretty clear, and it's a shall, and it's not worded in the way this is worded. And when you're referring to economically affected municipalities, this doesn't seem to be in context, in the proper context. So I think that it doesn't, that priority would not apply to an economically affected municipality.
Well, just perhaps to be clear, I'm really not concerned about the economically impacted issue here. That $125 million will evaporate. Everybody will be happy or not happy. I don't really care about that. I'm more concerned about the revenue impacted communities and who defines those, how the money flows through all the way from the North Slope to the Canadian border. Somebody somewhere has done some sort of work to show what that means on a broad per capita basis. What does that mean to the North Slope? What's it mean to the unorganized area? What's it mean to the New Delta Borough? What's it mean to Fairbanks? And whatever other organizations are included there. I'd like to see that, and I think it's very important that we take the time and that we do our work to make sure that we set up the benefit of this infrastructure that's being put in. The benefit of this infrastructure is spread statewide and just not to certain areas of the state. So if you could, I'd be more happy to work with somebody on that if you just point me in the right direction.
I will do that, sir.
And we talked about the education issue, and I think that's my concerns. Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Green.
Yeah, maybe I didn't understand. Senator Wilson, talking about revenue affecting municipality, would it not be, once the $125 million is gone, would it not be shut down as well?
There'll be a continuing PILT. It'll be paid under the agreement, and
so, it's a separate.
Yes, it's
okay. Separate. Thank you.
Senator Wagner.
Yeah, it's part of the contract.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
And that continues, and those payments continue in lieu of taxes at the municipal level. Right?
That's correct, Senator.
Yeah.
Senator Wilkin?
When the 125 is done, the economically impacted definition is moot.
That's how I understand it.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
This is when we look at and define spreading these economic benefits, you know, across Alaska, I assume that's a more narrow definition. It would be spreading the impacts along the line of the gas line and not broadly across the state. Is that not correct?
Correct. That's kind of how I understood it. It would be Juneau may or may not be economically affected or revenue affected as a result of that pipeline. Maybe Sitka wouldn't be.
Well, that's the point. I could see possibly Haines where they have a yard or an invasion point, but I have a hard time grasping how other coastal areas would be impacted, or the Aleutian Chain, or.
I think that's part of, also part of, I'm not speaking for Senator Wilkin, but if part of the reason that he'd like to have a definition of impact is so that we can determine whether or not there really is an impact on a community that would be making an application for the funding, and so that we truly had a definition to begin with, and secondly, from that, be able to determine with the advice of the municipal advisory board whether or not there really is that defined impact on a community making an application. Senator Wilken?
Yeah, and I'm thinking of it from kind of the other way. There's going to be a profit stream that flows out of this infrastructure, this thing called a gas line. And that all that money, that profit, what we get for the people at maximizing the benefit of the resource that is going to flow into this bucket. But before it gets to the bucket, there's going to be certain areas of the state. For instance, my borough. We're going to say we need that fire station, and we're going to reach in and we're going to grab some, and we're going to say that's ours. That makes the bucket smaller. So there's going to be areas all through here, down that pipeline and across the border, that are going to have special claims. We want to make sure that those special claims are valid, because whatever those 11 communities or municipalities or groups reach in and grab makes the bucket smaller. And at the end of the day, this legislature divvies up the bucket for the benefit of Sitka and all the people that will never come and see the gas line, but it'll be to their benefit. Now, they won't be impacted, but they'll be negative impacted if those requirements and those demands of the revenue stream, the profit stream, are improper or they aren't validated, then that bucket's smaller. And the part that's spread around the state, all across the state, to every person, is a little bit smaller because we haven't taken the time to make sure that first choice, that first cut, is proper and valid and can be quantified. That's the way I see this thing as helping people, all the people of Alaska.
Senator Seekins, I hate to interrupt, but could I make a statement?
Certainly, Mayor. Go right ahead.
Yeah, the revenue-affected communities are only places that have a property taxing authority, and they will not be able to collect property tax. So the revenue tax is speaking to those locations only. Once the gas line is completed and throughput is going on, the revenue impact means that they are not going to be able to collect revenue from property tax, and that was the entire point of that. The impact during construction is the $125 million. Once gas is flowing, the borough won't be able to collect property tax, so it's a revenue impact that has to be paid with a PILT from the state.
Okay, so it's not intended to go to unincorporated areas that aren't able to levy taxes under state law?
That's correct.
Except through, for an example, the North Slope Borough, who may use some of that funding for areas that are not particularly along the pipeline route, but it's the PILT in lieu of property taxes.
Yeah, they have to. It would be a replacement of the property tax that would be collected if they could collect a property tax on the gas properties.
Thank you, Mayor. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then a second reading of this is that in those areas that are unorganized along that corridor, they would be unorganized for 45 years. Is that correct? As they wouldn't be able to get payment in lieu of taxes.
If I wouldn't necessarily think that it does that. If they fall into the definition of a revenue impacted municipality in the future, they make that application through the commissioner, the way I read the bill. Maybe I'm wrong. For example, the future Delta borough were to come into existence after this is executed, certainly at that point they would qualify. Am I correct?
Because during the hearings that we had down at Centennial Hall, I think that was addressed, that these other areas would not be able to have new taxes because we have a lockdown, and if they have no new taxes, no additional PILT, then there's no basis for them to form. So if you don't know that answer, I think that's a crucial section to the boroughs that are along that corridor, and that needs to be answered.
Senator Wilken?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think Senator Hoffman, if I remember, first let's clear something up. Revenue impacted goes from first gas to last gas. Is that correct,
that's
Mr.
correct.
Baldwin?
Well,
or does it go from first gas, or does it go from sanctioning to first gas?
Well, the PILT is payable, I think, immediately from effective date.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
And does revenue impact the communities, municipalities stop at first gas, or does it stop at last gas?
I think it stops at last gas.
Okay. Last so if that's the case, then we're peeling off 0.001 some measurement, putting it into a bucket. And that bucket is for the unorganized areas to divvy up. And if a borough comes along, Deltana comes along and says, oh, we want to be a borough, then they're able to take part of that money, and then they also then attach themselves to the revenue stream. So they're incentivized to become a borough to get that source of funding that comes out of the throughput through the gas line. That's how I understood.
Well, there's another mechanism in here for figuring the miles that are within, yeah, of property within an area, and there's additional factors built in to allow for the addition of new municipalities. And I'd have to go back and reread that portion of the contract in order to explain it to you completely, but there are allowances here so that if there are new boroughs created, there would be enough capacity in the allocation formulas for them to get in into the PILT line of distribution. That's the intention, and as it's been explained to me.
So they wouldn't be locked out forever?
No, they wouldn't be locked out. It's devised in a way to allow for that kind of expansion.
And that's in the contract?
That's in the contract, yes, sir.
So I wonder if you could point that out to my
I can do that afterwards, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator, for bringing that question up. Other questions on this issue right now? Senator Elton?
Thank you, Senator Green, although it's a new topic, Mr. Chair, of question.
Is there any other questions on this particular topic? Are we all done and all through with this topic? Seeing no more, Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back and while Mr. Baldwin is up here. I want to go back to Section 3 on page 3 and ask for the rationale for the change on line 25, where this is under the provisions where we say the commissioner may develop a contract that may include, and it goes down to line 21 and says other terms or conditions that the commissioner determines are, then we've got A and B. I'd like to know the rationale for the change on line 25, where we go, we changed it from the best interest of the state to the long-term fiscal interest of the state, and the rationale for that change would be helpful in my understanding of where we're trying to get to here.
Ms. Baldwin?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The rationale... Okay, right. I'm told we provided a memo to the committee where we've explained this rationale just recently. You may not have it in your packets as yet, addressed to the chair, and I don't particularly want to start freewheeling here.
Let's see if we can track that memo down.
Yeah, and so...
Mr. Chair, I'm willing to wait for the memo. It's
fine. Okay.
I haven't read it recently, so I don't want to start skating here and then find that I've...
If you'd like, we can take a short recess in order to get it printed and into everybody's hands. We'll take a short recess to get the memo to everybody. Call the committee back to order. During the recess, we had a memorandum, that June 2nd memorandum given to co-chair of the House Resource Committee, and we would look at page 3, paragraph 5, if I'm not mistaken. Do we have a new expert here to fill us in?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joe Donahue. I'm the Preston Gates and Ellis, and Jim Baldwin and I are tag-teaming this... this particular session, and with your permission, I can go ahead and try to answer Senator Elton's.
If you would, Joe, please.
The reasoning behind the change to 7B on page 3 of the bill at line 25 is to render the findings necessary to defend a specific term and condition consistent with the type of finding that needs to be made to bless the whole contract. And it throughout the Stranded Gas Development Act, and I can refer to 4382-400A1, which is a provision that outlines what has to be in the preliminary fiscal interest findings of the Commissioner of Revenue. And in that statute, the Commissioner has to make a finding that the overall contract is in the best interest, is in the long-term fiscal interest of the state. That same language appears in the final finding that will need to be made by the Commissioner of Revenue at the completion of this public review, legislative review, possibly renegotiation process. And there's another provision that deals with adjustments to political subdivision taxes and PILT, and that's 4382-210B. Again, the adjustments have to be made consistent with the long-term fiscal interests of the state. We have, therefore, in coming at a new subsection 7, tried to render that finding consistent with the ultimate findings that the Commissioner has to make in order to progress this contract to a final finding stage, to the referral to the governor's stage, and to the governor's final referral to the legislature for authorization. So the House Resources Committee earlier this week asked us to take a look at the comparative case law on the subject of what does long-term fiscal interest mean, what does best interest mean. Well, best interest has been litigated in this state. It's been litigated in the context of the Department of Natural Resource findings. And there is a body of law that says, generally speaking, best interest means that it refers back to Article 8 of the Constitution, and it basically says the decision of the Commissioner of Natural Resources has to be done to the maximum benefit of the people and in the best interest, best public interest. So we, in the end, we don't see a huge difference. What we're trying to do is minimize potential litigation issues. Over here it says best interest. Over here it says long-term fiscal interest. And so this change is designed to rationalize the test that the Commissioner has to make for all the provisions of the contract, all the terms, and what have you. So that's a long way of saying it's a consistency edit within the Stranded Gas Development Act.
Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a follow-up, and I think I understood what was being said, but it would seem to me, and I'm going to toss out a premise that you can react to. It would seem to me that if the goal is to minimize potential litigation, that moving from a standard that has been litigated before and that has some basis in case law to a standard that hasn't been litigated before and hasn't been defined through case law may increase the potential of lengthy litigation. And you can maybe just react to that statement.
Yes, Senator Elton, I would say there is a body of law that tells the Supreme Court the constitutional provisions to look at, but it's a very amorphous test. I mean, it's what's in the best interest of the people. That could mean any number of things. It's not a hard guideline. And what's kind of where we find ourselves today in this process is the Commissioner has already gone through an elaborate effort to put forward the preliminary fiscal interest findings using the standard that pervades the Stranded Gas Development Act, which is this contract in the long-term fiscal interest of the state? And if this standard gets changed, I mean, if if this standard got changed to best interest, I don't think in this particular position place, I don't think it would do a lot of harm. But what we're trying to do is do good with our change.
Senator, these findings of long-term fiscal interest are, as Joe has said, are already in there. That is what the commissioner is tasked to present to the legislature along with to determine that prior to advancing the final contract to the legislature. Those findings of long-term fiscal interest would always be the same, also be the same ones that would be challengeable under Rule 602 of the appellate procedures, and would also be those that we just in Judiciary Committee this morning referred to a reference that could only be challenged after a contract was signed. So it would be consistency as to what the commissioner actually has to provide in his findings, you know, if I'm correct.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So it's not a matter of a term of art as much as it is a matter of consistency, I believe. Any other questions on long-term fiscal interest? Seeing Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your forbearance. I mean, this is what happens when I take a lunch break. I think of things that I should have asked in an earlier session. As long as Mr. Donahue is here, on Section 4, we had a lengthy discussion, and I don't recall if you were in the room or not, on subsection B, and the talk revolved around some of the language in here, and I guess I have a more basic question. I mean, this, and I'm not using legal terms of art here, but this seems to allow the ability to shop around for another court of jurisdiction and ask that court to enforce an arbitration award. And we talked about it in terms of, I think, the private partners having that ability. Does the state have that ability to also go to another court in another state to seek enforcement of an arbitration decision or award?
Senator Elton, under the Article 26, the rights to enforce the arbitration awards are reciprocal in the sense of going to other jurisdictions and enforcing them against other states.
So any party can do it?
Any party can proceed to another state that has jurisdiction over either the state in one instance or over the producing entity that you're having a dispute with in the other instance.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. On that subject, in the discussion, did you hear the earlier discussion we had on this subject?
I'm sorry, Senator. I was in another hearing.
Oh, don't be sorry. Be glad. We explored a little bit when this might be used, and as I understood the testimony we heard here, this might be used by the state if somebody that we were trying to use another state's courts to enforce the arbitrator's decision, we would be doing it in the state where there were project assets or activities. Maybe a module's being built somewhere, or it's across one of the Great Lakes states, you know, where the pipeline might run. So that was, I think, an example that was brought up where the state might want to do that. And I suggested that it might be where one of the folks we were in business with on the project might have their headquarters, you know. So, but we were struggling to, or thinking about, could we, on line 31, where it says the state, about seven or eight words in, is there a way that we can make it clear what the state means? So it wouldn't be us shopping for a friendly court anywhere in the South 50 or 49, but where it would be there, there was a clear connection, or however you guys talk about, there would be a logical connection to the state in which we would be appealing to their courts for remedy.
Senator Dyson, I'm kind of trying to think through your questions here, but maybe just starting off, given the substantial assets that the producing entities have in the state of Alaska, it is not impossible, but I would say unlikely, that the state would be shopping in other jurisdictions to enforce an arbitration award. The state could do that under the contract if it could not collect within the state or get its judgment, its award confirmed within the state jurisdiction. And then it could seek assets to have its arbitration award entered into other states like Texas or wherever the corporation that owed the state money had assets.
And if I understand this section of the contract, most of the time I wouldn't think we would be thinking a remedy in terms of getting money, but an arbitrator's decision to press for action, activity to happen as in progress on the pipeline or something like that. But am I wrong in understanding what mostly we think the arbitration process would do?
Well, Senator Dyson, I think what the waiver of sovereign immunity is intended to achieve here is more to put the state on an equal footing.
So that we can go to court.
With the producers in the context of solving litigation problems and enforcing judgments.
Mr. Donahue, we don't have to waive sovereign immunity in order to collect against them, do we? A judgment in our favor?
No, a judgment in our favor would be pursued like any other judgment against.
Excuse my interruption, Senator Dyson. Go ahead.
But what I was getting at is that why does this bill contain a request to include a term that waives sovereign immunity? And the concern of the producers, the commercial partners that the state is entering into a contract with, is that if they are left to state remedies only to enforce an arbitration award against the state, the remedies for collection on a judgment against the state are limited. The state assets, public corporation assets, are exempt from execution and attachment, and the only way that a private party can collect against the state of Alaska in the state of Alaska is to go ultimately take your judgment to the Alaska state legislature and ask for the money. So basically a judgment in the state court creates moral obligation essentially to have that paid. As I understand the process over the years, there's like a standing judgment appropriation, a small amount of money that's appropriated annually to cover small judgments, and from time to time when there's a larger judgment that may require special appropriation. So the issue really is the companies feel they're on an unequal footing because for litigation within the state.
So why would they want to, and I appreciate that, why would they feel the need to get into some other state's court system to come after us?
The primary reason would be that the judgment was large enough so that they couldn't recoup it under the waterfall provisions of Article 22, and that the legislature refused to appropriate the funds to cover the judgment otherwise. And at that point in time, they would seek enforcement against state assets elsewhere in the country. and which is, again, something we could do against them, but it's not as likely that we would need to because the state has, I mean, these companies have huge assets in the state.
All right. If I may, then, would you briefly explain to me what the waterfall, what that term means and how it applies here?
That's the Article 22 of the contract, and it basically describes all the obligations that run from the producers to the state of Alaska during the course of the contract, and all the obligations that run from the state to the producers. So it's the reciprocal obligations under the contract are described in Article 22. They're calculated on a monthly basis, and then they're netted out. And hopefully, and with a great majority of time, the companies will owe the state significant amounts of money at the end of the waterfall. The companies are allowed to recoup arbitration awards through this process. So if there's an arbitration award of $1 million, the companies could put that in their calculation of what the state owes them and net out that obligation the month that the award is entered. So it would be an unusual circumstance where the recoupment provisions wouldn't cover payment of awards. It would be a very unusual circumstance that if they did get an award, did enter a judgment in the state and come to the legislature for an appropriation, that the legislature wouldn't appropriate. That would be very unusual historically. But if that happened, then they would be entitled to enter that arbitration award in another state.
Or our state. They could go to our courts.
They have to go to our state first.
Our state court first.
They get an arbitration award, so the dispute is settled through a private arbitration process. The state may say, okay, we agree we owe you the money, and it might just settle out through this accounting process. The state might continue to object to it. And if it's not paid through this accounting process, then they would seek to have it entered in state court first and pursue judgment against the state. And as I indicated, that the remedy to enforce a judgment against the state of Alaska in the state of Alaska is to come to the Alaska State Legislature and ask for an appropriation.
Okay.
And so that is the reason the companies are seeking a waiver of sovereign immunity, so that if they are not treated fairly at the time that they present an appropriation to the legislature, they can go after the state's assets in other jurisdictions.
All right, so then in line 31, where it says they may consent enforcement and arbitration in any state court in the United States that has jurisdiction, it could say over the state of Alaska? Is that what that means there?
Yes, that's what it means, Senator. I believe that's kind of the drafting standard. I think that's from the drafting manual, the state and the state of Alaska.
Are there any states in the South 49 that don't have jurisdiction over us?
If the state doesn't have any assets in that state?
If the state of Alaska doesn't have any assets
exactly.
In the state.
Exactly.
All right, so that's what would give another state's court jurisdiction in this case, is if the state of Alaska had assets there.
In a general sense, yes.
And that could bank deposits, bank balances, ferry boat on the way somewhere?
It's a good example. I haven't thought about the ferry
boat. Okay,
but,
all right.
But that's,
thank you for the latitude, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So under the waterfall provisions, the producers are able to net out an obligation on the part of the state. What's the recourse of the state against the other parties if they refuse to pay?
under the contract, I believe the contract is ambiguous on that point. I believe that one reading would be that you would notice up a dispute, go to an arbitrator, and get an award, have it entered in the state court, and seek enforcement of that arbitration award against the company. I think there's another reading that if there's a clear amount due, let's say a production tax payment at the end of the waterfall, it's clearly amount owed and it's not paid, then the state could pursue that as a direct action to collect those monies. And I think we would need to talk to kind of Bob Loeffler and the negotiating team to get you kind of a better answer on that.
Just curious, because if we're trying to be on equal footing and one party can net out what's owed and the other party has to use normal collection procedures, we're not really on equal footing.
Well, within the waterfall, the state can net out its obligations too. So it goes both ways, but it's the ultimate issue is what if the waterfall doesn't work to compensate the parties at different times when over the course of the agreement, and if there's a huge, let's say, arbitration award that can't be recouped in, you know, a month or two, then that's when the parties are going to get into enforcement outside the contract.
Any other questions on the sovereign immunity issue? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Donahue, I guess one of the questions that I have basically is, are there other states that are involved where they've given up their sovereign immunity when they've been investors in some type of transportation mode for any of their natural resources, for example, Louisiana or Texas?
Senator Olson, I don't know of any examples of other states that have consciously waived sovereign immunity when they're doing business in another state. But there is a U.S. Supreme Court precedent on the question. And this goes to 19th century railroads, the state of Georgia operated a railroad in Georgia and in Tennessee. They had a railroad DP in Tallahassee. The city wanted to condemn the railroad depot. Georgia said, sovereign immunity, can't touch my railroad. And ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court said the state has no sovereign immunity when it's doing business in another state. It's just another entity. So
I'm assuming that there was no sovereign immunity waiving back when the Trans-Alaska pipeline was there either. I don't realize that Alaska was not part of the pipeline, but were there issues then?
Not that I can recall at this time.
I guess the discomfort that I have with trying to collect from another entity is a good example is the Exxon Valdez issue, where there's been a judgment and then it's been languishing for years before anything's been paid. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. As I understand it, the LLC is contemplated being incorporated in Delaware. Would this whole discussion have any connection to the fact that LLC would be incorporated in another state?
Senator Bundy, the rules for the fiscal contract are, and disputes under the fiscal contract will be resolved in accordance with substantive Alaska law. The LLC agreement that's being negotiated will be incorporated under Delaware law, will include provisions for alternative dispute resolution, and I believe that it currently reads that Delaware law will apply. And the basic rationale for using Delaware law instead of Alaska law is that Delaware basically has decades of case law interpreting its statute, its corporate codes, its LLC codes, what have you. And therefore, businesses all over the United States will frequently use Delaware law as the governing law of a commercial agreement, because in the context of a dispute, you're more likely to be able to predict outcomes and resolve disputes more readily.
I was just, by the way, provided from Senator Dyson a copy of the 2006 State Liability Systems Ranking Study conducted for the U.S. Chamber Institute for Legal Reform. And it lists Delaware as the number one state for having and enforcing meaningful venue requirements, overall treatment of tort and contract litigation, treatment of class action suits, treatment punitive damages, timeliness of summary judgment, etc. It appears that if you're a corporation and you want speedy treatment, you go to Delaware, it appears, from what I read in here, which is kind of another interesting topic. Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and for Mr. Donahue. I mean, if I'm remembering the tutorial that we had for 10 or 11 days a couple of weeks ago, it seemed to me that we were told that resolving disputes by arbitration, that the arbitrator is precluded from awarding punitive damages or losses. And if that memory is correct, I mean, explain a circumstance in which there may be a huge award in which somebody may want to go to another state.
Senator Elton, you're correct. The fiscal contract has provisions limiting the types of damages that the parties can pursue against each other. I'm less familiar with the limited liability agreement that's under negotiation, but I believe it has similar, fairly standard limitations on damages the parties can pursue against each other. An example of a huge award against the state, I frankly can't think of how that might develop.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Donahue, you said under the contract there is an applicable law provision that it's Alaska law that applies to the contract?
Yes, Senator.
Is there a CITES agreement in there as to where any dispute will be tried?
Senator Seekins, I believe there's in Exhibit C, there's a section that discusses where the tribunal would sit, and frankly I'm forgetting what it provides, but I believe it's by mutual agreement of the parties first, and then there's a default CITES, and I don't remember where that is.
Okay. I mean, my preference would be that it would be cited in the state of Alaska, but Senator Elton?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a request of the administration. It would be helpful. I mean, we've been told that this provision anticipates something that might happen, but if it happens, it probably happens rarely. But coupled with the response just a moment ago from Mr. Donahue, when asked, I mean, since the arbitrator can't award losses or punitive damages and couldn't think of a circumstance in which you might have an award that is too large to be handled through the waterfall part of the contract, I guess I would just ask for some kind of an example that demonstrates the need for this provision or this change in the Stranded Gas Act.
Okay.
We will try to provide one if we can think of one.
Additional comments or questions on this topic? Seeing none, we're willing to move on to the next topic. Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Donahue, if I could ask you to look at page 5, line 18, 19, and 20. We just touched briefly on this yesterday. This section of the legislation expands the powers of the Department of Revenue, or excuse me, the DNR, and with approval or agreement with the Department of Revenue, expands the commissioner's powers to enter into shipping commitments and long-term gas marketing agreements. But then down on line 18, 19, and 20, I just want to make sure I understand this. That sentence is really divided into two sentences. And the first section in that that stops at and on page 19 has to do with changing lease and unit expenses for separation, cleaning, dehydration, gathering, and saltwater disposal, which in my layman's terms means a gas treatment plant. But then my question is then, does the and preparation for transportation on or off the lease, does that speak to the gas processing facility?
Senator Wilson, I believe the answer is yes, that it deals with upstream field costs that the state is agreeing to assume. It deals with whatever processes are used to dispose of impurities and to bring the gas into pipeline quality condition. I would refer the members of the committee to question number 3 in the handout that we just passed around. This was again one of the questions that had come up earlier in another committee, and we provided, with the help of the Department of Natural Resources, a response which deals with the question of what are the differences between the existing oil and gas lease agreements and unit agreements and the proposed provisions of the proposed contracts. How does the proposed contract differ? And you'll see there that some of those differences relate to the cleaning, dehydration, conditioning the gas for pipeline quality. And this statute that you have focused on, or the proposed amendment, is part of the statutory authority that we're trying to provide for some of the for these provisions of the contract.
Mr. Chairman, I just can't help but think about next time we confirm a commissioner of revenue or a commissioner of DNR, we'd better make darn sure we know who we're confirming, because they're going to be very, very important people in the state government. And I look back to when we increased their pay last year, and a lot of people grumbled about that, you know. I suspect we may be thinking about increasing the pay again on a couple of these people, because we're going to want just about the best there is. So with that, thank you.
So, Mr. Donahue, if the state was taking its gas in cash rather than in kind, would these expenses be deducted from what we would receive in cash?
Senator, the answer, I think, is generally no. These are expenses that the state has taken on as part of the process of becoming a full commercial partner in the project, and would not otherwise be authorized under the leases and the existing agreements.
So these, in effect, reduce the value of our gas versus taking it in cash?
Senator, I think
it
sounds like a question for Pedro.
Yeah.
I think the argument is ultimately that the state, by taking its gas in kind, shipping it to Alberta or wherever, is likely to make as much or more money from controlling its gas disposition than it would from taking it in cash. But I think that's an arguable point, and I think the economists who are familiar with these calculations should probably answer that question.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions on this topic? Seeing none, we're ready for the next one. Let's take a moment to start with the bill. As I said earlier, tomorrow we're going to schedule public hearings, and on Sunday we're going to start with amendments on the bill. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have given your staff a couple of amendments, but if you would prefer to have them and then do a CS, or I can certainly offer them as amendments, whatever is the most appropriate.
I'd kind of like to see what we want to amend and see what we can maybe get ready in the form of a CS, and we'll probably then would take a look at amendments and come up with a second CS after the fact. Some people may want to surprise me with their amendments, and others might be willing to publish them ahead of time.
I'll wait on Christmas for your.
Yeah. But I'd like to spend a little time, if we're through discussing this at the moment, spend a little time on the other bill, on 2003. So if you'd like, we can start right in on that, or we can take a brief 5-minute recess. With pleasure. Start right in?
Yep.
Okay. First one to speak was Senator Wilkin. He said start right in. So
he's bigger than both of us.
He's bigger than us. Yeah. Right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have a question. If
Senator Bundy, please, I find my 2003. There it is.
Page 6, line 29, the governor shall promptly make an appointment. You know, I bet we could have 12 different definitions of promptly right at this table. Does that need to be a more clearly defined term, within 30 days or something? Because I could see someone, my past experience with governors promptly could last for years.
Point well taken. Anyone else? The question is, one of the questions that we did not resolve, or we didn't take a vote on, but I wondered if you wanted any more discussion on, because there was some after hearing discussion on whether or not we should have legislative confirmation. Senator Bundy.
To that point, my next point, Mr. Chairman, Tam Cook has rendered an opinion that our confirmation is unlikely to be enforceable or allowed. And I have a copy of that opinion that I can distribute to members if you like.
Like to get a copy if we can.
It's on its way.
Good. And I won't ask you until you have it in front of you as to, or of us, as to the reason that she felt it might be unenforceable.
Well,
I know Senator Green yesterday told me that it's been the tradition that that when the primary function of a board is to is for fiscal matters, that they are not subject to confirmation by the legislature.
Fiduciary responsibilities.
However, we can stipulate that they cannot be dismissed except for cause once they are appointed. So we would eliminate the wholesale replacement of a board on a change of administration.
Unfortunately, we also eliminate the replacement of individuals that we might like to replace.
Right.
Yeah, we do have
comments. The other question having to do with public members are residency requirements.
And Mr. Senator Chairman, Bundy. I will have an amendment to the effect that the majority of them should be Alaskans. If the administration needs some flexibility with outside expertise, I do think Alaska Hire ought to apply to the state as well as to private corporations. And Mr. Chairman, you now have the Cook memo, and it's summed up in the last sentence, I believe, the Board of Directors of the Alaska National Natural Gas Pipeline Corporation do not fall within the types of boards in which confirmation is required. So the amendment that I was seeking would not be legally effective in imposing a confirmation requirement.
Okay. Any questions on that? Thank you, Senator Bundy, for providing that for us. Other question that I wanted to throw back on the table for discussion is to the meetings of the corporation and how they should be held in public, quarterly. What would be the intent there, discussion by members of the committee? Senator Elton?
Mr. Chair, I mean, I thought your example of the way the Permanent Fund Corporation does its business, where the meetings begin in public, they have the ability to go into executive session for discussion of matters that otherwise wouldn't be public, is a better model than the model suggested in this, which simply provides that at least one out of four of the four required annual meetings be a public meeting. I'm much more comfortable with the model that you mentioned in the debate yesterday.
Senator Green.
Would you need any kind of provision, or is it perhaps already in there about an except in an emergency where you have to have a decision post-haste?
I think you'd do that based on notice, but we can look at that. Does anyone from the administration have an opinion on that? Mr. Donahue, did you folks want to comment on that? Senator Wilkin?
Thank you. I'm just wondering, how does the railroad do it? Would that be a model that we might want to follow?
Oh, no, Mr. Chairman. They don't give us any money at all.
Mr. Donahue.
I agree.
Mr. Chairman, I'm afraid I was distracted and I didn't hear the
question. We're talking about public meetings of the board of PIPECO or whatever we want to call it, and that we, as it's written now in the draft, it says one or more of its meeting in public every year. We were looking at different models there. The one that I mentioned on the Permanent Fund Board of Trustees was that our meetings were public. We would dismiss to executive session to talk about confidential or matters. And we, Senator Wilkin mentioned, we might want to take a look, see how the railroad does it as a quasi-public organization. Do you folks have any opinion or any reason why you proposed originally just one or more of the public meetings each year?
Senator Seekins, theory here was essentially to make sure there was at least one public meeting a year and not to preclude having every meeting public, but subject to executive sessions in which confidential information could be dealt with. The primary concern of the Department of Revenue, Steve Porter and others, is that that these meetings remain exempt from the Open Meetings Act, which puts constraints on how quickly you can have meetings, creates litigation points for lack of notice and subject matter of executive sessions and what have you. And if this AK pipe is going to be allowed to operate on an equal footing as a commercial entity with the other members of the LLC, the freedom from the Open Meetings Act is the primary goal. The fact, if this were to say three public meetings a year, as long as it wasn't subject to the Open Meetings Act and that they could have other meetings, emergency meetings, what have you, that weren't subject to those requirements, I don't believe there'd be an objection.
Okay. Any discussion on this topic, Senator Wilkin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would renew my concern about allowing votes on fiscal issues via teleconference.
Mm-hmm. Point. Maybe we got that. Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Elton, then Senator Bundy.
I just wanted to let the committee know that Mr. Porter extended the courtesy to me to stop by my office to talk about the issue of public meetings and open meetings. And we may, the committee may want to, or committee staff may want to touch base with him. My understanding is he understood the model that you had suggested, didn't seem to have any problems with it. He may be working on some language now.
Senator Wilkin, on the teleconference issue, all members be present, or could a certain number of members be available by teleconference?
Well, I would prefer to be all members.
Senator Bundy?
And along those lines, regarding the honorarium, it says works a portion of the day. I'd like the committee to think about defining what an adequate portion of the day is before the honorarium is granted, or whether there should be proportional amounts of honorarium. And if you meet for 1 hour, is that considered adequate for the honorarium to be granted? So I will bring forth an amendment to generate discussion, and I appreciate the input of the committee members.
One thing you may want to look at when you're doing that, Senator Bundy, I know when I was on the Permanent Fund Board of Trustees, sometimes I'd spend half a day in travel. Didn't meet. And a half a day to go back home to get a $400 honorarium for the day that I spent in Juneau. Is that what you want to do to the members of this board?
May say something about the judgment of which remote
Fairbanks has place never been considered
live,
remote, but
it's a topic, as I say, Mr. Chairman, of discussion that I
gotcha.
Would look forward to.
If Mr. Donahue, if you got a copy of the bill there,
yes,
on
I do,
page
Mr. Chairman.
9. Subparagraph 8, starting on line 3, question was brought to me that the powers of the board would be are to sell, lease as lessor, lessee, exchange, donate, convey, or encumber in any manner by mortgage, by creation of any other security interest or otherwise real or personal property owned by it or in which it has an interest, including any ownership interest in the project or in a subsidiary entity. Could this board of directors divest the state of Alaska with their ownership interest in the project simply by a majority vote of the board of directors?
Mr. Chairman, the question is whether the board could sell the asset by a majority vote.
Any ownership interest in the project?
I believe there are provisions in here that restrict the transfer of assets as long as there's obligations outstanding of the corporation. This is a public corporation. Its duty is to acquire an ownership interest and to maintain that interest over the life of the project. The provision here is primarily focused on allowing the board to use that ownership interest as an asset to allow security interests to be placed on it and what have you.
Would be pretty hard to do in the light of day.
It would be very hard to do in the light of day. It is
Everybody
an interest.
Would have to leave town in the middle of the night if they did it.
Maybe you give them a double honorarium.
Double honorarium.
Mr. Chairman, I think I need to look at this carefully. There would be no objections to clear language which limit the ability to transfer the entire asset.
It was a question I agreed to ask, and it's been asked. And I think we okay. Other questions on that topic? We've talked about on page 10 indemnification agreements, confidentiality agreements. Are there any questions or any comments, suggestions on indemnification or confidentiality agreements? Next question is on page 11, dealing with exercise police powers of the state on line 9. May not agree to terms that attempt to limit. Could you, for the record, delineate for us what the police powers of the state are?
The police powers of the state would generally refer to its sovereign authority to maintain the health and security of the state, to regulate criminal matters, to regulate commercial activity within the state.
Okay. Let's see, what else did we have that were questions that arose since yesterday? On page 21, line 14, subparagraph 4, we talked about information that's required to be kept confidential under agreement. Would the insertion of the word reasonably before required address maybe some of the concerns that we discussed?
Senator Seekins, I think that's a question for Mr. Porter.
Okay.
I know this provision has been hotly discussed with the producers, and they are very uncomfortable with this approach. They would rather have a complete exemption from the Public Records Act. The administration insisted that the Public Record Act apply, but did provide broader protections. And one of the main protections the producers see is the confidentiality agreement that is going to be part of the limited liability company agreement. So I think Steve Porter should probably respond.
Well, I know we have a confidentiality agreement in the Stranded Gas Act that delineates those things which must be kept confidential. And I'm just curious why we didn't use that approach here rather than just a blanket confidential.
Well, Senator Seekins, we did, in fact, incorporate some of the concepts from the SGDA, the information that would affect the competitive position of the corporation or owner entity, and five and number six, the information of the corporation.
Then we put a blanket on it.
So we did look to the SGDA confidentiality provisions as something of a model to apply here.
And that was what was concerning to me, is it? Then we put a blanket on top of that. So just anything that has to be kept confidential under an agreement. And I don't know how you get into that agreement. Does that mean that we have to agree to keep it confidential first, or that they take a vote and the majority agrees to keep it confidential, and so therefore it is confidential?
Senator, under the terms of the limited liability company agreement, I believe there's a standard definition of what is confidential and how the information would be shared amongst the parties. And again, one of the big concerns of the producers is that they're taking a public corporation into their partnership, and they've never done that before. The state has, I don't think, ever undertaken this type of involvement in a largely private limited liability company. And so there's a kind of getting to know you problem between the state and its public corporation concepts and the producers that we're talking to vis-a-vis the fiscal contract, and ultimately their affiliates that will be becoming members of the LLC. So I believe this is kind of a policy question that Steve Porter should address. I mean, as a legal matter, I don't see any problem with adding the word reasonably, but I think that's a policy question.
And when will we see the construction of the LLC?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that. I know every effort is being made to complete those negotiations in the very nearest time frame. Okay.
Senator Green.
Yeah. I guess I have a comment, because it seems like to me that just because you have a government entity in partnership with a public or private entity, that the private entity has to absorb the exposure of FOIA or whatever you have to require public release of information to them. And particularly under the circumstances when you have an operator who's in charge of the project and generally speaks for the group. And does it make sense to make them the same standard as the state of Alaska as far as public information? I don't think so.
Senator Green, there's no attempt to bring the members of the LLC or the LLC itself within the Freedom of Information Act.
I think I may have used the wrong term, but the call for information that normally under a government entity would not be kept confidential.
Senator Green, I think part of the problem, and maybe the current Public Records Act applicable in Alaska is somewhat vague as to the types of proprietary information that would be protected if challenged. It's somewhat vague, and the case law is thin as to what types of privileges would apply. And so part of the rationale for this expanded list is to clarify the nature and the types of business information, proprietary information, that could be protected by Alaska Pipe Corporation in the context of this commercial venture.
Thank you.
And then, Mr. Donahue, if we could look at page 27, section 12 of the bill, could you maybe just go through the effect of what section 4545-900 does, what it actually accomplishes here?
This provision is in the current law, and it basically provides that in the context of a construction contract in the state of Alaska, that a person cannot agree to indemnify another contractor for their sole negligence or misconduct. And so section 12 essentially is a prelude to section 13, and we make an exception to that rule that prohibits indemnification agreements that, from a state policy perspective, would be viewed as potentially relieving one entity from the responsibility of their own negligence. The section 13 of the bill is new. It's an exception from that anti-indemnity prohibition. And this is a provision that the producers have requested, and the state is requesting on its own behalf, because the standard mechanism for a joint venture between oil and gas entities developing this kind of a project is to hire an affiliated operator. That operator performs the service of managing the construction of the pipeline project and ultimately operating the project at no profit. So they are cost They're a cost operation. They don't take any profit from the venture. They are because they are operating at cost, and because they're not taking a profit, they don't want to take any risk. And so the risk then is absorbed by this agreement between the project entity, the LLC, and the operator to indemnify the operator for negligence for their own negligence or for misconduct by their employees. The theory then is that that liability is absorbed by the LLC itself. The LLC members can either decide to insure against that risk on an individual basis or self-insure, and we're told that the oil company is always self-insure, and basically the cost of the negligence of the operator would be spread amongst the members in proportion to their ownership interest and ultimately paid in that manner. So it's a manner of lowering the cost of the operation. The operator has, of course, as an affiliate of one of the members of the LLC, has every incentive to avoid negligence and to avoid misconduct. But in a huge operation like this, an undertaking the size of the natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to Alberta, there will be accidents. There could be misconduct by low-level employees that cause damages and what have you. And those are the types of risks that that are covered by this provision, and that would be essentially agreed to be absorbed by the limited liability company that's operating the project or the segment of the project that it owns.
So this indemnification flows directly only to the operator, the operating entity, and is not a cross indemnification of the owners of the project?
This indemnification provision deals only with it deals with two types of indemnifications. One is the operator, and the LLC will indemnify the operator for their own negligence and misconduct. There's also provision for the LLC to indemnify the members of the LLC for their negligence and misconduct. And again, these are ultimately contractual agreements. They're going to be especially on the misconduct side, they're going to be narrowly drafted to deal with certain types of misconduct by low-level employees that the policymakers of each of the partners cannot control. So so there's two types of indemnities, both being absorbed by the limited liability company and shared amongst the members. There's also provisions for if the operator decides that it needs to hire experts from BP to assist it in constructing the project or doing the planning or permitting arrangement, that those entities that are providing a consulting service to the operator can be similarly indemnified, so they're treated like the operator. Also, some companies may loan employees to the operator during the course of planning and permitting or possibly during the operational phase, and that type of lending of employees, rather than have that risk be carried by the parent company or the affiliated company, again, that is absorbed through these indemnifications back through the operator to the limited liability company.
So the actions of someone either hired temporarily by or loaned to the operator do not flow back as a normal course of business to their original employer, but simply they now are treated in terms of respondeat superior as an employee of the operator.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, they would be essentially the operator and any entity that has loaned the employee to the operator, or any entity that is providing consulting services to the operator. And these are entities that are affiliated with members of the LLC. So it's not just any consultant to the operator, but these are, again, part of the affiliated group that owns the membership interest, but has, for instance, expertise in geophysical studies or what have you that is necessary for the and for the benefit of the operator and for the entire LLC.
So if I understand this, then the negligence of an employee of the state of Alaska caused these damages, the damages would be shared on an equal basis by all the members of the company, of the what do we call it, the entity here, rather than just by the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct. As long as the employee is operating in connection with the operator, and involved in the construction or operation of the project. All
right. Thank you. Senator Green.
You didn't, I just want to be sure, you didn't say that the operator would not have to pay at all, did you? They still do their share of the 100%.
Senator Green, the 100% ownership interest would be shared by the Exxon, BP, ConocoPhillips, and the state of Alaska. And then the operator would be a separate entity, possibly affiliated with, most likely affiliated with one of the three producing entities. That would be the operating entity. They would not have an ownership interest in the LLC. They would be contractors with the LLC.
But the 100% would be divided among the four partners.
Senator Green, 100% of any liability incurred as a result of the indemnifications would be shared by those four members, yes.
Thank you.
In proportion to their ownership.
In proportion to their ownership.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Back on the membership of the group, on page 5, paragraph A, it lists pretty specifically things that would exclude membership in the board. And I notice elsewhere in the bill it talks about conflict of interest, but it doesn't exclusively exclude in this section executives of one of the major oil industries or one of their employees. And I'm just curious about that.
Is there any reason why, since we're excluding employees of the state, that we would not exclude employees of other owners?
Mr. Chairman, I can't think of a reason. I can't think of why a governor would appoint an oil company employee to this board, but if it did happen, or if there's fear that it might happen, then, I mean, obviously the goal here is to find experienced people to sit on this board who may be prior former employees, and then they would be subject to the conflict of interest disclosures to the extent they might have interest in the partners.
Senator Bundy, go ahead.
And as I read the conflict of interest section, it said they just simply had to declare the conflict. It did not preclude their eligibility, so perhaps you'd like to look at that, Mr. Chairman, as well. It sounds illogical that the governor would ever choose to appoint someone like that, but trust but verify.
Could you direct me to the conflict statement?
Oh, I have to.
Here it is. I found it. Bottom of page 7. Thank you.
Glad to help.
Thank you, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Senator Green. Other questions on 2003 while we're at it? Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a question of Joe. Is there, I've never incorporated under the laws of any state. Is there anything, once an incorporation occurs, or is there anything in the contract that precludes a future legislature from coming in and tweaking any of these provisions?
Senator Elton, I don't believe there's anything in the fiscal contract that would relate to the form of the Alaska member. But there are provisions in the LLC agreement that's being negotiated that would, and these terms have not been finalized yet, but to the extent that there are two or three major issues that the producing companies have focused on, and one of those is the treatment of confidential information, and one is board composition. They're very concerned that this be a standalone commercial operation as much as possible within state law. And they're very concerned about the handling of their confidential information with the state of Alaska. So there are provisions, they're called member default provisions, in the LLC that would be triggered by amendments to the this statute in the future. And there's a dispute resolution process that would be involved. I think there's a specific provision in the, under the powers. I think it's top of page 11, section 22. And this paragraph or power was put in there to authorize the Alaska Pipe Corporation to agree to that type of a provision within the LLC agreement. And again, at some point in time, it's my understanding the LLC agreement, when it's finalized, will be published and described and discussed, but it's not done yet.
Mr. Chair, just it may be helpful for the committee if the administration or administration council can go through the bill and point out to us elements in the bill that we may be precluded from changing in the future. This is one of the problems, I guess, with trying to do this bill before there's an LLC. We don't necessarily know where they are, but if in fact we're going to take an action that does limit the ability of a future legislature to tweak the PIPECO bill, I think we need to know where those problems may arise.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, I think the issue right now is that these issues are under discussion, and so the triggering mechanisms are not resolved, and the penalties for having a trigger pulled have not been resolved. So I don't think the administration could get it. And I'll have to check with Steve Porter in terms of the status of the LLC agreement, but I'm not sure we could give you those examples other than the generic ones that I did give, which are, we know they're focused on handling of confidential information. We know they're concerned that the board be as professional as independent as possible.
Mr. Chair, I guess my comment is this is a cart before the horse kind of issue. And I mean, there's a certain sense of discomfort that I have not knowing what kind of tweaks we can make to this in the future.
Well, that's kind of hard to predict. I mean, we're gonna do with this what we think is comfortable, and the LLC will probably have to comply with what we do here. I don't know how we could ever say a future legislature might be able to change this or might not be able to change this. That's kind of like shooting at a target in the dark. I don't know how you could predict.
Mr. Chair, I agree. I think it's difficult. I mean, a semi-analogous situation is how we're dealing with amendments to the Stranded Gas Act that implicate what kind of a contract can come back before the legislature for an up or down vote. In this situation, though, we don't have the luxury of applying an up or down vote to an LLC, that they're still kind of working on the structure. So, I mean, at least there's a stopgap when it comes to the contract. but there's not here, and so I guess what I'm saying is that this isn't the kind of situation in which we can come back and fix something that has yet to be built.
We've put the framework up there for the LLC to operate within, I think. And
Mr. Chairman, if I may. Mr.
Donahue.
I think the legislature would not be precluded from changing the law in these areas.
Right.
What would happen is there'd be certain penalties on the Alaska member within the LLC, and these penalties are limited by this power to effects on voting rights and effects on access to confidential information. Some of the proposals have been involved that have been relate to this provision involve forfeiture of interest and what have you. So to some extent, this is a narrowing of the types of penalties that could be imposed. Obviously, if there's substantial concern by the producing entities that a particular change is going to trigger their concern, trigger of dispute within the LLC, they could come to the legislature and oppose it. And certainly, the Alaska Pipe board members would come to the legislature and say this is going to create problems. But again, it wouldn't necessarily stop a future legislature from changing the law, but it would put a limit on the type of penalties that would could be applied to the Alaska member by the LLC.
Well, I can't imagine, for an example, that information that would normally be available for shareholders of a corporation could be held confidential from the people of the state of Alaska. I mean, that would be. I think what we're getting to is, you know, what kind of information is not necessary to be shared with shareholders of a corporation? And because in that effect, the people of the state of Alaska are really acting as shareholders through this LLC, I suppose, in their access to confidential information and information that should remain confidential to even from a shareholder would probably be what we would agree should be kept confidential in terms of public records. But I don't know how we can, you know, it's pretty tough to say what some future legislature might, and we're not bound, right? Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. You
just have some penalties in the agreement.
There would be penalties on the Alaska member, and those penalties are limited as described in this power.
Okay. I don't know how you could delineate those things that just could never be changed.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I'm going to use a couple of examples, and then I'm going to go back to the situation we find ourselves in with the contract. I mean, we're going to be making decisions by passing this on indemnification of sections 12 and 13 that you had spoken to earlier. We're going to be determining how many board members there should be, and what the, you know, what the, where they come from.
Right.
Those are two examples of decisions that we're making that a future legislature may want to tweak, may decide that, you know, tough to get a quorum with this, you know, many board members, we might want to change the size of the board or something. All of those things are potential changes that some future legislature may want to make. The way we've dealt with it with the contract is we're adopting the Stranded Gas Act amendments after having seen the contract to accommodate what the contract says. I mean, so the other way of doing PIPECO is to wait until they have the dimensions of the LLC, see what it is, and then and then adopt legislation authorizing PIPECO after we know what the LLC is.
Mr. Donahue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, I do believe it's and I'm not really a policy person, but the I believe it's the position of the administration to bring the LLC agreement for discussion and debate, but not for legislative authorization, but it would be reviewed in conjunction with Alaska Pipe. That is my understanding.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. my discomfort with the legislation probably revolves around more my own inadequacies than anything else. But I know that these 29 pages are very important. I also know that if I told you I knew more, if I understood 2.9 pages of it, that would be the extent of my knowledge. So I don't understand corporate law nor structure nor these things to the extent that I'm comfortable with this legislation. But there are people that do, Mr. Chairman, and I would hope that you've asked some of the legal and the professional advisors that we have on board if they can look at this and tell us where the green lights, the yellow lights, and the red lights are to help us understand the problems. It is important, and I don't want to overlook the gotchas. And I'm not sure that there's any sort of a real time crunch on this one as there may be on other legislation. So I would hope we'd be beneficiaries of that expertise to take this apart and tell us where the good things and the bad things are for our future considerations.
Okay. Senator Stevens.
Thank you. I might have missed the conversation, Mr. Donahue. I apologize. So this is the LLC management agreement we're talking about. Is that correct?
The agreement that's being negotiated, yes, Senator.
And has there been any discussion at all of the LLC operating agreement?
There has, Senator Stevens, there has been discussion. I don't know where those discussions stand.
I think that, you know, we need to stay in consideration that LLCs function with two main guidelines. There's the LLC management agreement that says the rights of each member within the LLC, and then there's the LLC operating agreement. And that's how the business functions. And that's how the business manages it. And it's historically an evolution that the first piece passed is the management agreement, where the parties agree to come together. And then the second piece is the parties together develop the operating agreement on how they'll function. It's an evolution of a business relationship that follows along, and it happens on every LLC in existence that have more than one partner. So from my personal experience and from my personal understanding, I have no expectation that by the time this contract comes before us for ratification, that there'll be a operating agreement in place. The operating agreement may not come into place for 3 or 4 years on how the members will agree to operate. I think it's an important distinction that we all have to remember, is that the management agreement is the members' rights within the organization. The operating agreement is how the organization will function and how the monies will flow through the operation. And all this pipe bill does is set up the public entity that will become a part of the management agreement. So this is essentially the formation of the embryo that will become a part of the living body, being the management agreement, that will manage and grow the company through the operating agreement.
Senator Green.
Senator Stevens, though, do you think there's any different standard required when you have a government involved?
That was the question I asked yesterday about the Sarbanes-Oxley requirements, where we are a government, essentially a public. Mm-hmm. We are a public-owned entity joining in an LLC with publicly held companies that are subject to Sarbanes-Oxley and SEC regulations. And will we therefore become subject to SEC regulations ourselves? And I don't know the answer to that, and I think, I can't remember the woman's name was here yesterday. She was going to try to find out.
Yes, Senator Stevens, I know Luann Cutler has looked at that question. Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to talk to her, I don't know.
But that's an important question. I don't know.
But Senator Stevens, if I just might respond to your earlier point about the operating agreement. It is my understanding that in these types of arrangements, the management committee, the decision to come together as an LLC, is closely related to the decision as to who's going to operate the agreement. And so it is, the operating agreement is closely associated. It may not always be simultaneous. It may never be simultaneous. I'm not an expert in those. But I think it's very closely related because the management, the partners make their decisions based in part on the expectations of the lead partner who wants to be made the operator. So there is a closer connection, I think, in this type of LLC.
There is, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
And I don't disagree with that, but also, but one of the things that those of us that have been involved in LLCs understand is that the LLC evolves through participation, and it's a constantly changing function, where the management agreement is almost the engraved a doctrine in stone, and then the operating agreement is the flexible document that allows the entity to move forward with the changing dynamics in which it faces. And so we are forming, this PIPECO legislation forms an entity that becomes a part of the engraved stone element. Because we know we will not be an operator. We know that for a fact. We won't, at least it's my expectation. We certainly hope not. We won't have
we don't want to be.
Short straw.
But, I mean, and I have concerns along with Senator Wilkin about the evolution in the establishment of the corporation that becomes a part of the LLC. And I also will have a lot more understanding when we actually see the LLC management agreement. But at that point, as from the legislative perspective, I don't think we need to have much concern about the operating agreement because we're giving authority to the PIPECO to be our representative in the LLC. And that the LLC will manage the operating agreement. So I think that for us to say that we need to see all the way down into the functioning, the elements of the corporation as it moves forward, I think we may be asking a little bit too much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other comments or questions this afternoon? I want to, for the record, and I neglected to mentioned it when I first saw her come, but for most of the afternoon, Senator Davis has been with us. And I want to thank her for being here.
Yes, she has. Been very faithful.
Very faithful. So, Senator Davis, thank you very much, and forgive me for not putting that on the record sooner.
Good night and good luck.
Anyone else? Any other comments? Here's our schedule for tomorrow. We start at 9 a.m., and it'll be, we have... We'll have comments from, if they are available. We know at least BP has asked for some time to have comments and answer questions. ConocoPhillips will have time made available to them, as well ExxonMobil. And we'll have public comment on Senate Bill 2003 and 2004, public testimony, for as long as it takes for us to accommodate those who would like to testify on these two bills. We'll provide, Sunday at 2 p.m., we'll meet. Here we'll entertain amendments from members. We'd like to have those amendments drafted by the Legislative Legal Department and provided to Brian prior to the meeting, if at all possible, for dissemination. I imagine we've opened that. I've allowed any member of the body to bring to us a proposed amendment for our discussion.
So other than members can bring an amendment to us. If we run out of people to testify tomorrow, and some of those amendments are available for consideration tomorrow afternoon, we may take advantage of some of that time to begin to consider some of those. But at this point in time, I believe we'll it's hard to tell what our public response will be for public testimony. So count on at least by 2 o'clock on Sunday we will be entertaining amendments. Any questions? Hearing none, it's now 5 o'clock straight up, and we're adjourned for the day.
It will depend on-